Stay tuned for The Cinema Clash, as Maryland-based critics Charlie Jewell and Hannah Buchdahl debate the merits of new releases, from the mainstream movies that Hannah tends to favor to obscure foreign films that Charlie likes to champion. It's free-flowing, unedited conversation with an occasional wine wager. Two very different perspectives, one entertaining podcast. Let the clash begin.
Hello and welcome to The Cinema Clash. I am Charlie Jewell of charliejewell.com.
And I'm Hannah Buchdahl of chickflix.net.
Week two of getting the band back together. And I know you're excited because you've been waiting for this movie forever. The biggest movie we're going to talk about. It was on your most anticipated top five list of 2020.
Yes, that's right.
That's how long.
And then on my most anticipated list of summer movies that we ended up doing a few weeks ago. So yeah, finally we're able to talk about In the Heights, because now that you've seen it.
I did. I watched it on HBO Max, so I didn't see it on the big screen. So folks at home, HBO Max works just fine if you don't I could see it. We'll get into it.
All right.
But I did. I got a beer today, and I matched it. This is from up the road in Frederick, Maryland, from Flying Dog. It's called Pool Hopping Deck Beer. Brewed in the deep end.
And what does that relate to?
Come on.
Pool hopping. Because it was hot in the Heights.
It is in the Heights. You're correct that it's in the Heights. And one of the major musical numbers takes place in the free public pool.
Oh.
At the top of that building.
That is a stretch. Mine's a
little... What do you mean a stretch? That's like one of the biggest musical numbers. Like in the top three.
Well, mine is a little more straightforward. And it is called Caribbean Paradise.
Oh.
And it is mango, papaya, pineapple, dragon fruit sour. I have no idea what it is. It's some kind of beer from Homemade Brewing Company.
Where are they located?
And Homemade is spelled Homaide. I don't know.
Antietam.
Oh my gosh. Wait.
Hagerstown.
Hagerstown, Maryland, which is not exactly...
It's up there.
Caribbean paradise.
It's
location.
Not. I've been to Hagerstown one time, and it's not. It might be a paradise, but it ain't Caribbean paradise.
But anyway, so that also is to go with In the Heights, because it really is sort of about one guy's dream of returning to the Dominican Republic to open a kind of seaside bar.
Well, I like the transition, because I was going to say everyone in the Heights, and I mean everyone, has a soñito. They have soñitos, everybody. Why don't you tell us, Hannah? Because you're going to do the heavy lifting on this one, since this is your film, about the soñitos going on and in the Heights.
I'm trying to remember what that meant. Was that the dream?
It's the little dreams.
The little
Everyone dreams. Has a little dream.
Everyone has a little dream. And so anyone who's seen the Broadway show of In the Heights will know that the storyline involves a blackout in the midst of a heat wave that sort of provides this opportunity for all the storylines to intersect about the lives of these people in the Washington Heights neighborhood of New York City. And they are mostly Latinx population. And the little dreams center somewhat also around everyone likes to buy their lottery ticket because, everyone in that neighborhood sort of just latches on to what that could represent and the dream that they'd be able to have. That is what the extent of my Spanish for this film would be. But I talked a little bit about it last week because you know that I love my Broadway musicals. I love my Lin-Manuel Miranda, who's best known for Hamilton, but actually created In the Heights before Hamilton. So I had really enjoyed this film. I think it's just one of those feel-good movies for the summer that people have just been waiting for, and I think it meets most people's expectations, and so I think that's a good thing. So more important than what I thought of it, what did you think of it as the not-so-familiar-with-Broadway dude?
Well, I didn't have expectations. I knew Lin-Manuel Miranda, and I knew this was beforehand. This is like way beforehand. This is 2008. So that's quite a bit, actually, before Hamilton. And I heard the similarities. The beats and the flow are there. There's some carryover. And actually, there's a very, I don't know if you caught it, there's a subtle Hamilton plug in there.
Oh, there are a few Easter eggs. There are Easter eggs for various people.
I laughed at one quite mm-hmm. big. But In the Heights is very, it's very plotty. Very plotty. So it circles around actually two couples. Our main man, Usnavi, by Anthony Ramos. He carries the film. He might not be the most important character, but he's in almost every scene because you got to have a through character, and everyone kind of orbits around Usnavi's experience. He runs the local bodega. You know, he's a community man. He loves his community, but he sees, like everyone else, that Washington Heights is gentrifying. Hippies are moving in. Not hippies, but hipsters. Hipsters are moving in. And their $9 a shirt dry cleaners are kicking out, you know, the little corner stores. And, you know, the salon owner has to move up to the Bronx. Jimmy Smits, who owns the local cab company, you know, he needs to sell up because his daughter, Nina, played by Leslie Grace, is going to Stanford. And she couldn't just go to NYU or Columbia. She had to go to Stanford, right? So that tuition is quite pricey. Usnavi's in love with Vanessa. I really liked her, by the way. Mm-hmm. She's played by Melissa Barrera. And Nina's in love with Benny, played by Corey Hawkins. If you remember Straight Outta Compton, Corey Hawkins was Dr. Dre. The blackout and the lottery ticket are both cogs. Their plot...
It plays a bigger role in the stage version. So that is something that people who know the stage version very well will be trying to figure out where the film adaptation diverts, because there are some songs that have been cut, there are some characters that have been cut, and the lottery angle is much stronger in the original because it also gives the surrogate grandmother to everyone, Claudia, Abuela Claudia. She has the lottery storyline is bigger in the play version. It plays out differently in this film adaptation.
Directed by John M. Chu, he did Crazy Rich Asians. An admirable job. You know, there's a lot. This is really stuffy. There's so much going on. It's very busy, but there's even some what felt like dead spots. But my favorite numbers were by the opening one, where, mm-hmm. you know, you introduce all the characters through song. Okay, I can see his arc coming up. I can see her arc. And I really liked, it's during the blackout where the salon owner comes out. It's like, hey, get off your butts. You know, let's have a carnival. That was a really strong one. Mm-hmm. I didn't like the song, but I liked the dancing between Nina and Benny when they're dancing on the side of the building.
Oh, see, I didn't like that one.
I didn't like the song.
No, but I did not like that that particular scene took me out of the reality of the rest of the movie. Like, for me, somehow it was suddenly this gimmick that didn't fit to me what was happening with the rest of the film. So while I thought it was kind of cool, I didn't like that they did that. I found it to be somewhat distracting. But, you know, that was just me. So obviously different folks are going to get different things out of it. And I don't blame the director, John Chu. It's a lot, you know, to try and adapt this theatrical, you know, from 2008, this Tony-winning musical, into something that's more contemporary, because they did add several layers of a more contemporary storyline, through line, in, you know, with Dreamers and things like that, stories that weren't as high profile in 2008. So they added stuff, they subtracted stuff, and I think that that just sort of made it maybe a little more bloated than it needed to be. There's a very long Abuela Claudia's big number, her spotlight number. To me, it played better in the show. The woman who plays Abuela Claudia is the same person who originated that character, that role. She won a Best Supporting Tony for that role and 13 years ago. So for her to be able to recreate it and still pull it off, I think it was wonderful. But she has a very long number in this film. And I just felt there were some places where it could have been nipped and tucked just a little bit. But again, I love musicals. And to me, these are the kinds of movies that you can just sort of watch over and over again. I always suggest that people try and see this one in the theater first, because with a really good sound system on a big screen, you're going to get more of the cinematography, the vibe of this neighborhood that, for those who are in the know for New York City, I know it pretty well. My grandparents lived on 170th Street in Washington Heights. That's where my dad grew up. My nephew now lives right off 181st Street, which is really right outside, which is where this all takes place. So Washington Heights is this neighborhood in the shadow of the George Washington Bridge, right near the 181st subway stop. So I say you watch it on the big screen, and then you can rewatch it. If you have HBO Max, you rewatch it, you kind of see the parts again that you want to see again. So I think a lot of people are just going to enjoy this movie because it's just the kind of movie we just kind of needed right now. So I think it serves its purpose.
It's light. There's really nothing heavy in it. Even though things do happen to people, it's a musical. Like, nothing bad, nothing really bad. There's nothing really that can't be overcome or compromised on by the end. There's a lot of comparing and contrasting, especially when it comes to musicals, especially by somebody you know. First of all, the most blatant one is with Hamilton. Hamilton's better. Hamilton's a lot
better. It's different.
You actually can't say one is better than
the
other?
No, because Hamilton was really just you're seeing the stage performance.
But the songs are better.
I don't see, not to me. It's different. They're just very different.
You're crazy.
I know. I would just also point out, John Chu, this is his first real feature, movie musical feature, but he's actually now tapped to direct a cinematic version of Wicked. So that's in pre-production. So it'll be interesting. This is kind of cutting his teeth on this big picture kind of thing.
Now, Wicked's a musical I've seen. I saw it in London's West End.
Yes, I saw it in New York with Idina Menzel and Kristen Chenoweth. So yes, I saw it a long time ago. But so I do think there people like different styles of musicals. And so,
I'm not saying you have to pick or you have to champion one, but online, there's already a fight. Already a fight online on what's better, In the Heights or the upcoming Spielberg West Side Story. And no one's seen West Side Story yet, but people are already going to the mat.
I know, it's crazy. Well, no, I think some people have seen it. I think West Side Story has been in the can for so long, just like this one was, that I think a lot more people really, it's probably leaked to a ton of people. And there was so much buzz about the West Side Story adaptation before we really were hearing about In the Heights. And so, it's Spielberg. It's like really hard to compete with Spielberg. But Lin-Manuel Miranda just feel like he came from behind and might overtake Spielberg with this. But I do think I'm glad that they weren't butted up against each other in their eventual premieres, because Spielberg's West Side Story now is slated to come out, I think, around Christmas. And so that gives us that gives us some breathing room between the two. And I think you're going to end up actually appealing to essentially the same base. I think the people that were eager to see In the Heights will be equally eager to see come wintertime West Side Story.
Well, I'll give In the Heights the edge because they haven't made a movie that before. I've seen West Side Story. I've seen Rita Moreno as Anita. Speaking of, Rita actually gets name dropped in one of the In the Heights songs very early on when they're talking about, cultural heroes. They name drop them all, and Rita's right in there. Speaking of Rita, next week there is a documentary all about Rita, which you made me go ahead and watch early because we're not doing an episode next week due to vacation business. But tell me about how are they treating Ms. Rita Moreno in this new documentary.
Yeah, no, so I wanted to see it because, one, I knew we weren't going to be able to talk about it next week. And there's a theme going here, whereas the documentary called Rita Moreno, Just a Girl Who Decided to Go For It, it is executive produced by Lin-Manuel Miranda.
He pops up. Indeed.
And Norman Lear, actually.
He pops up, too.
But Lin-Manuel Miranda does pop up in this because Rita Moreno was one of the pioneers for the Latinx community in Hollywood. And I learned a lot. I really, you know, all I really remembered about Rita Moreno was she was in West Side Story, and she won a Best Supporting Actress for originating the role of Anita in West Side Story, which was, I think, 1961. And she's been around a while. She's had this 70-plus year career, and I didn't know really her backstory, and it's really pretty fascinating. She had come from some very poor area of Puerto Rico and ended up with her mother coming to New York back when, like, Elizabeth Taylor was also a teenager. And somehow she ended up meeting Louis B. Mayer, who said, "You're just like the Latina version of Elizabeth Taylor," hired her as a studio contract player, and that's how her career started. But the stories that she tells about what she had to endure in terms of profiling and casting and sexism, and how she was always cast as, like, any dark-skinned role, whether it was Polynesian or Egyptian. And so there was a really funny story that was in there. It was told by, I think, Eva Longoria tells it, about how she just had this universal accent, and she would just use the same accent. If you are a Russian, this is how you talk, like this. If you are Dominican, you talk like this. If you are Polynesian, you just talk like this. And it was actually very funny, but at the same time, it was kind of a bittersweet story to tell, because you just realized that she wasn't being recognized for her acting ability so much as just the look that she could provide in these various studio films over the years. And then I'd forgotten that she was a featured character in Electric Company, which I watched growing up, which was sort of like the, you watch Sesame Street and Electric Company, and they were both these children's educational shows. And I just discovered that, my God, Rita Moreno has had quite the life, and she's endured a lot.
I did not know. I knew about her career. I did not know about her personal life. Mm-hmm. And she is very, very open. She stares directly at the camera, and she tells you about the rape.
Yes.
I didn't know she had a 7-year relationship with Marlon Brando. I had no idea. She tells you about the abortion she had of Brando's child. Wow, way to go, Rita.
Yeah. I mean, well, she tells you about her husband that she probably wasn't all that much in love with. But
yeah,
hey,
after he died, they had a relatively long marriage. He was not part of Hollywood. Maybe that's why it lasted as long as it did. But now that he has passed on, she says, actually, everyone thought we were happy, and it was this idyllic marriage, but we were quite miserable, don't you know?
Yeah.
Good Lord, you will learn a lot about Rita.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
She's here to tell it to you. She's not hiding. Maybe because she's 87, she has nothing to hide, nothing to lose, nothing to be shy about. It's like, this is me. This is what happened. And a lot of it happened to her. It's not necessarily the choices she made. It was the choices foisted upon her by the studio system. And yeah, I felt really bad about the stereotyped roles she had to endure to get anywhere. But
at the same time, it's like she was living the American dream. And so you hear about that too, as to how she was able to achieve exactly what she always wanted to do. And I think she's like 89 now. So it opens with like her 87th birthday party. But I love, you see her stripped down, makeup free. She's watching the Kavanaugh hearings, you know, that are taking place with Supreme Court, and you see her reaction to that. And she is one of the only people, she's got the prestigious EGOT. She's got the Emmy, the Tony, the Grammy, and the Oscar. And so to sort of understand how all that came together and what she's been able to achieve and what she did have to overcome, I would say keep an eye out. I think it's only in theaters first next week. This isn't one where I don't think you have to rush out to the theater to see it, but I would keep an eye out for when it starts streaming. But it's Rita Moreno, Just a Girl Who Decided to Go For It.
Here, our next film is about a gentleman who is also deciding to go for it. He's going all the way from New York, where he's a travel writer for the New York Times, all the way to Tel Aviv. He's the intrepid traveler, and he goes to cities for, you know, 5 to 7 days to tell you the real story about the city he's visiting, not just what the guidebooks will tell you or what the internet buzz will tell you. He's going to go find it out for you. So Michael, kind of a stuffy 50-something, I would say. They never say his age, but I'm going to guess that he's in his 50s. Played by John Benjamin Hickey, who is a Tony Award winner, by the way, for 2011's The Normal Heart. Mm-hmm. He sublets a 20-something's, a 20-something gentleman's apartment. That's Tomer. And he arrives, and Tomer's not ready. Tomer, he's an experimental filmmaker. He's still in film school. He is a free spirit. He gets the wrong day. He's not ready to receive Michael. His apartment's a pigsty. So Michael's like, oh, great. But, Tomer obviously needs the money, so he makes it work. And he becomes Michael's seeing eye dog, really. Let me show you the real Tel Aviv. Yes, I see your list here. And he makes fun of him. Like, yes, it's a Jewish princess's birthright to her list. Let me show you the real Tel Aviv, because this is Time Out London's sexiest neighborhood, you know, of the world, though. So 50-something Michael actually sees 20-something an Israeli's Tel Aviv, and it's a gay story, yeah, because yeah, you know Michael he's married to another man back in New York, and we're not sure for a while about Tomer's inclination.
No, but and it's called Sublet, by the way, and it's an Israeli American kind of film, so it's mostly in English, and it was pitched. I mean, it's actually in that LGBTQ genre. That's how it's defined. And it is Pride Month. And so we've been getting a lot of pitches for watching various films. And so this was one of them. It's also, I think, premiering at the Tribeca Film Festival. And it's in theaters June 11th. And then it'll be on demand in July. So it's... you know, I think it's not just about Michael seeing things through Tomer's eyes. It's also Tomer seeing things through Michael's eyes. And so it's one of those kind of standard stories where by the end, they've each sort of learned something new by experiencing the perspective of the other. And Michael's obviously suffered some sort of tragedy, and he's kind of estranged from his husband. You don't quite know, you know, throughout most of the film exactly what happened, and then the pieces kind of come back together. But what I thought was really interesting is, did you happen to capture the tiny little subplot about the stolen bike?
Yeah, that reminded me of one of the Oscar
eye.
Shorts.
Yes, yeah. It was actually, I think one of the characters' names was the same, and a bike is stolen, Tomer's bike is stolen at one point. And just like in White Eye, he doesn't want to turn in, he doesn't want to report it because he's afraid of how law enforcement will actually react to the immigrant community that was reselling, somebody who was reselling the bike. So I was like, wait, I just saw this story as a much, you know, and framed in a slightly different way. But here's your Hebrew lesson for the day, because it was Mazeh Productions. And I don't know if you know what Mazeh means.
Take one guess.
What is this? So Mazeh means what is this? So it's What Is This Productions, which I thought was kind of cute. But anyway, it was actually quite an impressive debut. You talk about how Michael is played by a Tony winner. Tomer is played by this guy, Niv Nesim, and it's his first big role. So I think for a, I thought it made for an impressive debut. This is not my cup of tea for the most part. It skews arty for sure. But it was, you know, it was interesting. I would call it an interesting flick.
I agree. Sublet has charm, but I'm not going to, you know, run to the rafters to shout its name. I think we kind of agree right down the line on this. However, if you are one of our Washington, D.C. listeners, this is showing at the Avalon Theater. Now that the Uptown is closed, and the Avalon, which is in that gray Chevy Chase neighborhood, you know, you're not sure if you're in D.C., you're not sure you're in Maryland. You know, it opened in 1923. You know, this is an old movie house. It's nonprofit. It's community supported. So if you've actually, I've been there one time, saw the Florida Project there. So if you've never been to the Avalon, you should check this out. I mean, Sublet is a perfectly fine 90-minute movie to squeeze into the Avalon.
If you're sort of the arty indie foreign film type of buff, then this is certainly one you might want to be.
Get some piragua.
That's right. We forgot to mention what Lin-Manuel Miranda's role in The Heights is, because Lin-Manuel Miranda played Usnavi on stage, but in The Heights, he just appears as the guy selling shaved ice on the street, but as the piragua guy.
All right, now we're going to split. Hannah went her way to see one that I told her I was not going to see. And then I went my way and I saw two things that she said drop dead over. So take us away and tell me about Grandma's behaving badly.
Well, I saw queen bees, and the first thing I did was immediately message you that you did not have to see this one because I knew that you would cringe all the way through it. It is what you liked. I call the movies for grown-ups movies, and you call movies for old people. Mm. And it is the same target demo as Palms with Diane Keaton a few like a couple years back, which I think you also skipped, perhaps.
I did.
And I did. So I knew that this was not for you. But it is, you know, it is a couple of some high-profile actors playing their age and representing, but we've seen it all before. And essentially, it's you've got Academy Award winner Ellen Burstyn, who I haven't seen in forever. She plays this fiercely independent senior named Helen, whose house is going to be in need of repair because she mistakenly leaves a pot overflowing on the stove and fire in her kitchen. And the daughter's like, that's it, that's it. She wants to sell the house and get her mother into the senior living community down the street. But Helen is like, no, 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 I'm going to get the house fixed. This is my house. I'm moving back. This is where I've lived for 40 plus years. And so they strike an agreement that that Helen will move into the Pine Grove senior community just temporarily, just for a few weeks or a month. Month tops to get while the house is getting fixed back up. And wouldn't you know it, you know, this Pine Grove senior community is filled with, there's friendships and love potential, the lusty seniors, and then Queen Bees really refers to this group of the mean girls. Helen says they're like the mean girls from high school, but with medic alert bracelets. And so the mean girls are led by Jane Curtin, I think, plays the meanest of the mean girls. But you've got Anne Margaret. When was the last time you saw Anne Margaret on film? Loretta Devine. They play a mean game of bridge, and you know, they lock people out who they don't like, can't join their club. But of course, Helen manages to kind of, get, even though she's reluctantly there and insists that she's going to leave as soon as possible, she ends up just kind of breaking in with the mean, cool kids who are in their 80s and 70s. And then James Caan is there, shows up as a love interest for her. And Christopher Lloyd from Taxi shows up, and from Back to the Future and a bunch of other stuff. He shows up as a potential love interest for one of the other characters. But you've seen every plot line, every aspect of this story before, and you kind of know how it's going to end. They're trying too hard with every single subplot, you know, to get in the one person with dementia and the one person who has a stroke and the one person who is, you know, the bachelor is sought after by all the old women in the, you know, in the community. It was just kind of stereotypical to me how they just sort of played with each of these storylines. And even though there, you know, there's some authenticity to it all, it just felt a little contrived as well. But it totally reminded me of Palms. And I went back and looked, and Palms on Rotten Tomatoes had a score of 36%, but 73% was the audience score. And I think this is going to be very similar. It's like, if you're in the target audience for this film and you liked Palms, then you're the ones who are going to go see Queen Bees. It is not for Charlie.
That's because they're going to forget they watched it. It
so it is. It's like, it's just, it's the most redeeming thing about it is just seeing these veteran actors that you don't get to see all that often anymore. But the story itself and the film itself is kind of weak.
If we were playing a game called Dead or Alive, I would have gotten it wrong. I would have lost the game. You would have said Anne Margaret, and I would have said dead. I honestly, I had no idea she was still.
And she still looks fabulous.
But when you said, when's the last time you saw Ellen Burstyn? I was like, what are you talking about? She had Oscar buzz last year. But oh, you didn't see Pieces of a Woman. Starring Vanessa Kirby in the ultimate labor scene ever filmed. Yeah, Ellen Burstyn was in that, and she had a lot of best supporting actor Oscar buzz around her.
All right. Well, then she's continuing her... She's on a roll.
No, she's not.
80s.
She went downhill after that film into something called Queen Bees.
Yeah.
So I saw two things, and man, boy, do they sound like Hannah films, let me tell you. But the first one, let me start out with the better one. It's called Aquila's Escape, written and directed by one Charles Officer. It's in select theaters and digital platforms. It was at the Toronto Film Festival last year, and it was nominated for 7 Canadian Screen Awards. That's, hey, right on right there, huh?
Hey.
It's billed as an art house crime noir. Heck yeah, turn it on. Art house crime noir, hook it up. There are two mirrored storylines. We got present day 40-year-old Aquila, and Aquila is played by Saul Williams. He's a poet, an actor, and he also did the score for this film. And he lives in Toronto, and he operates in the weed business. Weed's legal now, so he's actually growing marijuana legally. The other storyline is Aquila as a 15-year-old in the mid-90s in New York City. And in both storylines, he's trying to resist the violent life. As a 15-year-old, his father is the general. He's the general of the local gang, the local Jamaican army. And he's, that's not Aquila's, you can just tell, he's a sensitive soul. And in present day, these youths rob, they rob the product. They rob the money, and they steal the line, you've heard the line before, you stole from someone you don't steal from. They stole from the Greek. You don't steal from the Greek. So Aquila, instead of, he captured one of them. He captured one of the boys, this 15-year-old boy, just got wrapped up in business. He has no business being involved in it. Aquila takes one look at him. He's like, that was me. That was me when I was 15. So instead of torturing the boy, killing the boy, and killing his family, Aquila's like, I'm going to do this my way. So he's as trying to save the boy, he puts himself in danger with the Greek. So we got these two competing parallel storylines of what's going to happen when Aquila was a kid, what's going to happen now in present day. There's a lot about the Jamaican subculture. These are all, most of them are Jamaicans, and there's themes about toxic masculinity. There's a better way. This reminded me, I don't know if you saw this, in 2018, we talked about Yardi. Yardi was famous because it was Idris Elba's first time directing a feature film. And it's like, ooh, man, where have I seen bits and pieces before? Oh, it was Yardi. And there's a really deep something that just totally hooked me about what's going on with cannabis. The drug war ruined countless lives when marijuana was illegal. Now that it's legal, the government's like, hey, we regulate this now. We own this, and it's totally awesome. And that just rubs Aquila the wrong way. This is a wonderful little 90-minute vignette of stiff-arming the violent way. It just works on all levels. I really appreciated Aquila's Escape.
Well, if you took your art house crime noir...
Absolutely.
...and you mashed it together with my movies for old people...
Nope.
...do you know what movie this would be?
Hit me.
Aquila and the Queen Bees.
Don't you? You're talking about the...
Yeah, remember
the spelling
Aquila?
Bee movie? Yeah, Aquila and the Bee?
Yeah.
That's a stretch, but I'll give you... Half plus one cool point.
Maybe I should just keep drinking this really weird beer that you bought.
No, but seriously, if it's in one of those select theaters near you or on a digital platform, Aquila's Escape, I swear, will treat you right, especially the performance by Saul Williams.
I wasn't a huge fan of Yardi. I mean, I watched Yardi mostly because it was an Idris Elba film. So art house film noir or crime noir is really just not my wheelhouse. But for those who do appreciate... that sort of vibe, sure, I would say, give Aquila a shot.
66% of the words right there just have me. Art house and noir. Mm-hmm. You put those together, I'm in. All right, the second film I saw is called Take Me Somewhere Nice. It's mostly in Bosnian, but there's some English and Dutch. It's also got a 100% fresh tomato. You don't see that a lot. Also in theaters and virtual cinemas, this 100% fresh tomato. It's a first time... feature film director. She's a Bosnian refugee who now lives in the Netherlands. Ina Sendijarovic.
Uh-huh.
She's created a character, a young 20-something called Alma, also played by newcomer Sara Luna Zoric. She travels back to Bosnia. She's never been to Bosnia. She was born in the Netherlands. She goes to Bosnia because her father, who ran off when she was really young, is sick. He's in the hospital, possible deathbed. Okay, I'm going to go visit dad. She flies into, I suppose it's Sarajevo, they don't name drop it, and her cousin Eric is supposed to pick her up, shepherd around, take her to the hospital. Well, Eric, he's not the sharpest tool in this shed. He's got his own game going on. He certainly does pick Alma up at the airport, but he leaves her at the apartment, and that's it. Like, no, I'm not going to drive you to the hospital. If you want to go there, you find your own way. She doesn't know anything about Bosnia, so she finds her own way. And in the process, she loses her luggage. She loses her money. She can get in a very bad situation very quick. And this is a road movie, and it's an absurdist road movie. So we got cars, we got buses, trains, hotels, waiting rooms. It's a fish out of water story, but it's also find your identity, who am I story. It reminded me of two kind of road ambling movies, Y Tu Mamá También, you know, like 2002 Mexican film with a young Gael García Bernal, and Garden State. Like, Zach Braff and Natalie Portman could show up at this movie and scream into the infinite abyss, and I would totally get it. Like, they belong here. This won a special jury prize at the Rotterdam Film Festival. I compared it, it made me compare it to Sublet a little bit. There are couplings by two characters here where it doesn't quite work. That happened in Sublet. I was like, oh, I can see why they did it, but it doesn't work. And they do it again here. Alma cohabitates with somebody, and it doesn't quite work, but I see why they did it. But the director, this first-time director, she can really frame a shot. I mean, some people might get a little jaded by this, especially you, which is why I told you not to watch it. But like, nothing's going on here. There's no plot. Nothing's happening. When, in fact, I would say everything is happening. But it's so gorgeous. The production design. Hi, Eddie. Podcat. Yeah, thumbs up for me on Take Me Somewhere Nice.
Well, I didn't watch it also because, it was very funny when you said that it was 100% Rotten Tomatoes. Because my view was, the only people who want to see this movie are Charlies who are going to be already inclined to like this particular movie. And therefore, you have your 100%. But Artie Chick did review it for Chick Flicks. And she compared it to, she said it felt akin to Scarlett Johansson in Lost in Translation. Because she said it's this, person who's unmoored from anything familiar, and she's looking for something and someone to hold on to. And so that's what she compared it to. But Artie Chick did enjoy it as well. So Take Me Somewhere Nice, again, it's one for the Artie crowd. So we've had to sort of divide and conquer with a lot of the stuff going on. And so I'm always going to, I'm going to sort of always lean towards the more mainstream option. But I also know when something like a Queen Bees comes along that I'm not going to subject you to it.
Sofia Coppola held back in Lost in Translation. Scarlett Johansson did not get to know Bill Murray, if you know what I mean in that sense. They did in Y Tu Mamá También. She experienced both of those boys, which is what they do in Take Me Somewhere Nice, which is why I thought about Scarlett Johansson. I was like, oh, she didn't cross the line with Bill.
As far as we know.
As far as we know. Maybe that's Lost in Translation 2.
Ooh, interesting. But we are off next week. And so when you talked earlier about Fish Out of Water, I did get an early look at Luca, the animated fish out of water tale that takes place on the Italian Riviera. So that one's coming down the pike. I did not get to see The Hitman's Wife's Bodyguard with Ryan Reynolds and Salma Hayek. I want to see that one, perhaps.
Yeah.
But I'm not sure. By the time we come back, we'll be knee-deep in AFI Docs, which is starting in about a week and a half. And so we'll have a lot of documentaries to watch. And it's a hybrid this year, so it's sort of... we'll be watching everything from home, but there will be some people who will venture into a theater again to see some of those documentaries. And I'm going to be judging, also coming up in the next few weeks, I'm a judge for this inaugural Next Generation Indie Film Awards, and they're going to be handed out in the fall, but I'm going to be tasked with watching a bunch of films that I won't be able to tell anybody about for many months to come.
I bet they... But they were going to have you be a judge. And they're like, oh, wait, she likes Queen Bees.
Yeah, I know.
So Next Generation.
Who knows? We'll see.
This is the next Homer.
I know. So it's a little odd casting, I agree. but we'll see how it goes. So I'm excited.
No, this is good. I think it's gonna help you. It's gonna expand your horizons.
It will expand my
your palate is gonna get cleansed, and you're gonna be like, hey, Charlie, do you know about the next art house crime noir? I'm Jones in here.
and then I'm just going to be like, you know, you really need to judge this, and I'm going to throw it on you for next year. So who knows? Oh, and I didn't get to see Loki. I'm kind of curious. The Loki series, is that on Disney Plus? I think
it is Disney Plus. Yeah.
That one's starting to roll out, and I've heard decent things about it. I think people have enjoyed the first two that they've seen in previews. But for some reason, I just didn't have access to it, and so I have not seen that yet. I'm not sure. I'm kind of a little burned out now after, you know, I enjoyed the Winter Soldier one and WandaVision, but now I kind of feel a little oversaturated with some of these things. So I'm not sure I'm going to take the time to get caught up in
another
series.
You're
going to
watch it. You
think I'm going to watch Loki?
Yeah, I do, because you got to get ready in case something pops up in Black Widow, which is right around the corner.
That's true, and I do like Tom Hiddleston, so we'll see. But maybe I'll let you watch first and tell me what you think.
Yeah, I didn't watch it yet because I'm waiting to watch it with the kid. And we RSVP'd for our first film in forever. We're going to go see the Boss Baby sequel.
Yes, I know that was on your list of most anticipated summer movies.
I can't wait to see that movie.
Sounds good. So we'll take next week off, and then we'll be back and do our next recap, especially with AFI Docs being underway. So that's it for this edition of the Cinema Clash. I am Hannah Buchdahl.
I am Charlie Jewell.
Have a good one.
Thank you.
The Cinema Clash with Charlie Jewell and Hannah Buchdahl is heard twice each weekend. At 5:15 on Saturday and 12:15 on Sunday afternoon. Join us again next time for The Cinema Clash.